let me tell you what I wish I'd known when I was young and dreamed of glory. You have no control.
Who lives, who dies, who tells your story?
President Jefferson.
I'll give him this. His financial system is a work of genius. I couldn't undo it if I tried. And I've tried.
Who lives, who dies, who tells your story?
3 years before Alexander Hamilton died in a duel, John Marshall was appointed to the Supreme Court, going on to become its longest-serving Chief Justice. In an 1819 case called McCulloch v. Maryland, the Marshall Court ruled unanimously in favor of Congress's constitutional right to establish a second national bank, the successor to Hamilton's bank. Why has this case been called one of the most important Supreme Court cases in American history, and how has it been used in discussions of everything from slavery to national health care? I'm Emily Auerbach, and this is University of the Year. My guest today is David Schwartz, Foley and Lardner Bascom Professor of Law in the UW Law School, and the author of the 2019 Oxford University Press book, The Spirit of the Constitution, John Marshall and the 200-Year Odyssey of McCulloch v. Maryland. Welcome to University of the Air.
Thanks for having me.
I'm always interested in why someone chooses to write a book when it's such a labor to put together a study like this. What led you to this particular Supreme Court case and an entire book exploring its 200-year history?
Well, McCulloch versus Maryland was the first major Supreme Court decision on the scope of national powers. And that question is really the deepest and the oldest debate over the meaning of the Constitution. It's always been fascinating to me. It's extremely important. It was the primary concern of the framers and the ratifiers when they created and adopted the Constitution. It's generated a lot of constitutional cases in the Supreme Court, really in every generation. And it continues to this day, as recently as the 2012 decision on the Affordable Care Act. And this issue is going to come up again when the Congress hopefully addresses our largest problems like climate change and economic inequality. Those laws, if and when they get passed, are certainly going to be challenged on the ground that they exceed the powers of Congress. And McCulloch versus Maryland, I think, holds the key to answering that question.
So it's really the question of whether the national government can overrule the states in terms of the legislation that Congress can do?
Yeah, the big debate in the founding era was how to divide up power between the federal and the state governments. And that's this 230-year argument that we've essentially been having. The view is that the more power the federal government has, strict constructionists say it takes power away from the states. That in itself is debatable, but that tends to be the issue when some kind of cutting-edge legislation is enacted by Congress.
You know, having seen the musical Hamilton fairly recently and then reading your book, it seemed as if you could imagine a sequel to Hamilton where it would be called Marshall, looking at this very complicated man who owned, you mentioned, I think, over 100 slaves. And then played a key role in the Supreme Court. Can you kind of take us to his origins and sort of the early story of John Marshall himself as a figure? Because I think we don't know too much about him generally.
Marshall is the perfect American figure to build a myth around because somewhat like Abraham Lincoln, he was born in a log cabin in the kind of rural hinterlands of Virginia and rose to incredible national prominence over the course of his life. He had the most illustrious and colorful career of any Supreme Court justice. He was a combat veteran, one of only two justices to serve in combat, the other being Oliver Wendell Holmes in the Civil War. He fought in Washington's major battles in 1777. He survived the winter at Valley Forge with Washington. And he went on to become a very wealthy lawyer in Richmond by building up a law practice. He was elected to Congress. He served on an extremely important diplomatic mission that was nationally prominent, served briefly as Secretary of State under John Adams, all that before becoming Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court. Very different kind of life than our current Supreme Court justices who go to Harvard or Yale Law School, practice for a few years, serve on the bench in a lower court, and then go to the Supreme Court.
What kind of personality did he have? I think I read somewhere somebody describing him as having sort of lax and loungy sort of manners, or?
He was a frenemy of Thomas Jefferson. They were distant cousins, political opponents, and personally disliked each other. And it was Jefferson, the aristocrat, who pretended to be kind of a man of the people, who described Marshall as having lax, lounging manners. Marshall was kind of the flip side of that. He was genuinely a man of the people, coming from these humble origins, having fought in the Revolution, but then became politically aligned with the Federalists, who were sort of the more elite political party at that time. But he was famous for being friendly and engaging and able to win over his political opponents. And historians generally agree that as Chief Justice, he was able to unify a court that was really divided between these two political parties. And everybody, he was able to get everybody to agree with him, basically, by his conviviality.
It's funny, but the case that I had heard of prior to your book, I heard more about, was the Marbury case of judicial powers or judicial review. That preceded this one?
Yeah, Marbury versus Madison is the first important case issued by the Supreme Court after John Marshall became Chief Justice. And that's generally regarded as the case that set the precedent giving the Supreme Court power of judicial review. So that's an important case too. But there's debate among historians about how important that one really was, whereas there's much more consensus about the importance of McCulloch versus Maryland, because that really seemed to establish the idea that Congress has powers, implied powers, that go beyond what's written in the Constitution.
Well, let's get into the case itself. Tell us who McCulloch was. Why did this come out of the state of Maryland, and how did it wind up in the U.S. Supreme Court?
Well, McCulloch was a constitutional challenge to one of the first federal governmental agencies, the Second Bank of the United States, which was the successor, as you said at the beginning of the hour, to the First Bank of the United States that had originated with a proposal by Alexander Hamilton in 1791.
Which Jefferson opposed, right?
Yes,
at
Jefferson.
That time.
Jefferson and Madison both opposed it. The Bank of the United States, in both its first and second incarnations, was a public-private entity, corporation, that acted as a central bank and also as the financier for the federal government. By 1819, the Second Bank of the United States had branches in all of the states, and because it was partially private, they conducted private lending operations that competed with state banks. And so state legislatures, some of them, got fed up with the idea that there was this national corporation that was competing with their state banks. And so the state of Maryland got the idea that they could drive the Maryland branch out of the state by imposing taxes on it.
So taxing a national bank.
Exactly. So the bank claimed that Maryland had no power to tax a federal instrumentality. And Maryland responded that Congress lacked the power to create the bank in the first place.
And so, McCulloch is the cashier at the bank?
Yes. So the cashier at that time, that was the title for the person who ran the branch of the bank. So he was named as the plaintiff challenging this tax by Maryland.
So Maryland's state Supreme, I guess maybe they didn't have a state Supreme Court or whatever, or did they? Like, how was it ruled in Maryland?
Well, the Maryland courts upheld the tax, and the case quickly got in front of the Supreme Court. And the historical evidence suggests that both sides were very interested in having the Supreme Court rule on this. So they kind of patched up a case and got it through the lower courts very quickly.
And were there other states watching very closely at this point? I mean, you said that there were branches of this national bank in many other states.
Yes. So as true today, the states had, you know, there were red states and blue states. the 1819 version of that. And so some states were quite happy to have branches of the Bank of the United States in their state, and some were not. And so all, I think, people in all of the states were interested in the outcome of this case.
With Marshall as the Chief Justice at this time, what kind of court was he chief over?
Well, by 1819, we had we had 19 years of presidents who were in the opposition party to Marshall's original Federalist Party, starting with Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, and then in 1816, James Monroe. All three of those presidents were Virginians. They were all Jeffersonian Republicans, all believers in states' rights and strict construction of the Constitution. And so by 1819, the Marshall Court consisted of John Marshall. At that time, there was one other Federalist appointee from before 1801, but the other four members of the court were all Jeffersonian Republicans.
So explain how the court heard this argument, what kinds of cases, you know, what both sides presented. What was the argument, by the way, for having a national bank?
Well, the argument for having a national bank really dated back to the argument over the first national bank. In 1791, when the first bank, when Alexander Hamilton's plan was debated in Congress, there was a policy debate on both sides. And then kind of at the 11th hour, James Madison, who at that time was essentially the Speaker of the House, got up and said, "This is unconstitutional because there is no phrase or clause in the Constitution that says you can charter a bank or any corporation for that matter." And to respond to that argument, the proponents of the bank in Congress said, "Well, Congress has implied powers that don't have to be spelled out in the Constitution. They have the discretion to do anything that is reasonable and efficient and expedient to enact the purposes of the Constitution and to effectuate the granted powers of the Constitution." Well, they won that debate, the proponents of the bank, because they passed the bill. But then the bill went to George Washington to sign or veto, and there was a debate in his cabinet. Thomas Jefferson was on one side. He said the bank was unconstitutional, wrote Washington a memo. And Alexander Hamilton was then asked by Washington, "Can you respond to this and tell me what you think?" Hamilton pulls an all-nighter, writes this famous memo laying out arguments saying that Congress has implied powers. Those arguments from Hamilton get picked up by the lawyers 28 years later in front of the Supreme Court.
Why did there need to be a second national bank? In other words, wasn't the first one good enough?
The first bank was chartered for 20 years, and the charter expired in 1811. And by that time, there had sufficient opposition to the bank had arisen because of the dominance of the Jeffersonian Republican Party that the bill to renew the charter of the bank was voted down. It was a very close vote by one vote in the House and a tie-breaking vote by the vice president in the Senate. And so we had no national bank when the War of 1812 broke out. That turned out to be a disaster because, financially a disaster, because the government found that it didn't have one-stop shopping to borrow money to finance the war. They had to go around to state banks and get a little bit here, a little bit there. In addition, because the currency of the country was paper money issued by all these different state banks, we didn't have a uniform national currency. After the War of 1812 was concluded, James Madison, who had initially opposed the first Bank of the United States, asked Congress, "Please charter a second bank. We need a bank to get this currency issue under control."
What about the part of the case that involved the state's ability to tax the national bank? How did discussions of taxation come into play?
Well, so the McCulloch versus Maryland, the opinion that it was issued by the court basically has two parts. The first part was the discussion of whether Congress had the power to create a national bank. And that turns out to be the part of the case that has been more important over the years. The taxation part, the second part of the case, is less famous, but it's also important. And it held that states did not have the power to tax an instrumentality of the federal government. And Marshall's reasoning on this point was, in his famous phrase, the power to tax is the power to destroy, that if a state could tax some operation of the federal government, whether it be a bank or the post office or an army base, they could essentially make the taxes so high that they would wreck the federal government operation. And so rather than seeing a kind of middle ground, Marshall thought, you know, it was a choice between two extremes. And so he sided with the federal government and said the states can't tax the federal government at all.
It says in your book that the decision was unanimous, which seems surprising given the makeup of the court that you mentioned, with so many who were Jeffersonian sort of states' rights justices. How did it end up unanimous?
Marshall instituted the practice that we're now familiar with of having an opinion of the court. Now when the Supreme Court writes, there is a majority opinion speaking for all the five or more justices who voted in the majority, and there might be a dissent or a concurrence. Before Marshall became Chief Justice, the practice was every justice wrote his own opinion in every case. And Marshall thought the court would be stronger if it spoke with one voice. So he worked very hard to create unanimity whenever he could. And he did this, I think, in two ways. Number one, he worked harder than anybody else. He wrote approximately half of the Supreme Court's opinions during the time that he was Chief Justice, you know, way more than his proportional share on a six-member court. The second thing was that he, you know, with the force of his personality and his legal acumen and smarts and just his powers of persuasion, he tended to get people to go along with him. I think the presidents Jefferson and Madison were very disappointed that their appointments, that their appointees so frequently sided with Marshall in these cases.
Can you share a little bit of the language from the Marshall case, for the Marshall ruling on this case?
Sure. I'll read you the most famous phrase from the opinion, the one that's most often quoted in U.S. Supreme Court decisions in later years. Let the end be legitimate, let it be within the scope of the Constitution, and all means which are appropriate, which are plainly adapted to that end, which are not prohibited, but consist with the letter and spirit of the Constitution, are constitutional.
So that's where you took the title of your book from then, The Spirit of the Constitution.
Yes.
So Marshall is, if we were to paraphrase that, is more or less saying that it doesn't have to be specifically stated in the Constitution, but you try to find ways to gather the spirit of it. Or isn't that a little bit risky if people gather the Constitution's spirit in different ways?
Well, the passage does have some ambiguities. I think the main gist of it is, as you said, to acknowledge the idea of implied powers, that Congress has to have some discretion to decide what are the best means to implement the powers granted by the Constitution and to implement the purposes of the Constitution. And yet, at the same time that he is giving Congress this discretion, there are hints that he's taking a little bit back when he says that the means that are appropriate and plainly adapted are going to be constitutional so long as they consist with the letter and spirit of the Constitution. And so what he's saying is that there is a spirit of the Constitution that might authorize the court to say that Congress has acted unconstitutionally. So it leaves, I would say, Pandora's box open just a crack.
Well, and you mentioned that the idea of sort of implied powers was used to justify the draft. In other words, if the Constitution doesn't say that the government has the power to institute a military draft, but it is supposed to be able to fight a war, then that would be an implied power.
Exactly. And in fact, it's an implied power. You could link it even to the enumerated power to raise and support armies.
Can you share some more of Marshall's wording when he is talking about sort of the enduring power of the Constitution itself? He seems as if he, I'm not going to say worship the Constitution, but he definitely venerates it as a document that is sort of living, breathing, and enduring. wouldn't you say?
Yes. One of the most important things that he says in the McCulloch opinion is that the Constitution was intended to endure for ages to come and to adapt to the various crises in human affairs. And so this is another way of reinforcing the idea that the federal government and Congress in particular needs to have the discretion to change and adapt as unforeseen circumstances and problems arise if the Constitution is going to endure. And so Marshall is clearly envisioning that this republic will last for a long time under this Constitution.
Sometimes he's been called the expounder of the Constitution. What does that mean exactly, to expound it?
Well, expound means to explain. And when he's called the expounder of the Constitution, it comes from the fact that there was not very much constitutional litigation in the Supreme Court before 1801, before Marshall became Chief Justice. And so many important constitutional cases, constitutional issues, were decided by the Marshall Court for the first time. And Marshall wrote most of those opinions. So essentially, he's writing on a clean slate because it's the first case of that type that would have arisen.
It must have been so exciting, you know, to be sort of the first. I mean, he was the fourth Supreme Court Chief Justice, but he's the first one that we really think of much. But it must have been pretty exciting to be writing brand new kinds of rulings.
I really wonder that. That's a great question. It's certainly, from the vantage point of hindsight, when we know that the United States succeeded as a nation and has lasted for over 200 years, from our vantage point, yes, it would be exciting to go back in time and play that role. But there's another way of looking at it, which is, for someone in Marshall's opinion, there's a lot of anxiety. Mm-hmm. Is this country going to last? And that was a theme that really jumps out when you read his correspondence. He's writing letters to close friends, and they're just filled with anxieties about whether the nation is going to hang together. The forces of states' rights and strict construction under these Jeffersonian presidents was so strong that Marshall was afraid the nation would break apart, states would secede, and the United States wouldn't last. He lived through a couple of different secession threats. And this is, you know, he died in 1835, so we're talking decades before mm-hmm. the Civil War. The New England states had made noises about seceding over the War of 1812, which they opposed. And then later in his life, in the early 1830s, South Carolina was so outraged by a new tariff law that had been enacted by Congress that they claimed the right to nullify federal law and were also making noises about the right to break away from the Union.
Before we leave the Marshall case and look at its 200-year legacy, can you share the famous passage from it about the Constitution?
Well, so there are several passages where he tries to explain why we have implied powers. And one of the key points he makes is that, quote, "a constitution to contain an accurate detail of all the subdivisions which its great powers will admit and of all the means by which they may be carried into execution would partake of the prolixity of a legal code and could scarcely be embraced by the human mind." What he's saying there is you can't expect the Constitution to spell out every legislative choice in advance. It has to be written in broad general terms so that ordinary people can read and understand it, which was the intention during the ratification process. This was turned over to the public and said, what do you think? Should we enact this as our new constitution? And he concludes this passage with what may be the most often quoted line from the opinion. "In considering this question, then, we must never forget that it is a constitution we are expounding." Why is that quote so evocative? It's because it's vague and suggestive. It's hard to know exactly what it means. I think in context, what he's simply saying is constitutions are written in very different language from statutes, from acts of Congress. Those are going to be detailed. They're going to be wordy and prolix. They're not going to be reader-friendly. But the Constitution is written in broad generalities. It's something that a person with a high school education could sit down and read and hopefully understand.
You mentioned that Marshall dies before, quite a bit before the Civil War, but that's going to lead us to the question of how does this case, McCulloch versus Maryland, play into a discussion of slavery and whether the country can institute one rule about slavery. More on that when we continue in a moment with the University of the Year. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with David Schwartz, and we are talking about a famous Supreme Court case. It's called McCulloch versus Maryland, establishing the power of the national government over the states. We talked about the fact that John Marshall, this long-serving Chief Justice of the United States, owned slaves, yet he's arguing for the sovereign power of the national government. He didn't live to see the Civil War, and you warn about asking that question, what would John Marshall do? But what would John Marshall have said, do you think, had he lived into the time of Abraham Lincoln and been part of the discussions of whether the states could institute their own rules when it came to slavery?
I think John Marshall was probably somewhat ambivalent on the question of slavery. Slave owners and the slave states tended to be strict constructionists because they were afraid that if the powers of the national government were broadly construed, that that could authorize Congress to regulate and perhaps even abolish slavery.
Let me interrupt once. So when you use the term constructionist, that refers to sort of a strict reading of the Constitution, a narrow reading of it rather than sort of expanding its reach?
That's right. And in this particular context of federal government powers, strict constructionists tended to say Congress is strictly limited to the enumerated powers, that is, the powers that are listed right on the text of the Constitution. Well, there was no power listed to regulate slavery. And so slave states thought, here's a protection. If we can interpret the powers of the government to be limited to the things that are listed, we're going to protect slavery from federal regulation because there is no slavery regulating power mentioned. So they were concerned about implied powers. Marshall was a major slave owner, which is strangely, I think, because he's been such a mythical hero for so many legal historians and constitutional historians, they've tended to overlook the fact that he owned well over 100 slaves. He bought and sold slaves his whole life. He never freed any of his slaves. And yet he was not, he didn't follow that kind of slave owner strict construction path. He was a strong believer in the Union. He was a strong believer in national powers. And I think he was reluctant to strike down an act of Congress.
So during the discussions in the Civil War with the threat of secession and then just kind of trying to work out where the reach of the national government extended to with slavery, how did the McCulloch versus Maryland case get referred to?
Well, the McCulloch versus Maryland was not a popular opinion in the court of Marshall's successor. The next Chief Justice after Marshall died was Roger Taney, who is famous or infamous as the author of the Dred Scott case.
Yeah.
Taney was a strong advocate of, he was appointed by Andrew Jackson. He was a strong advocate of states' rights. And he was a strong advocate of slavery. And he tended to interpret the Constitution in a pro-slavery way. He believed in national power only when it was the power to enforce the Fugitive Slave Act, for example. One of the things that he decided in the Dred Scott case was that Congress did not have the power to ban slavery in the territories. I don't think Marshall would have reached the same conclusion. I think he would have reached the opposite conclusion had that case come before him. What the Taney court did was they just basically ignored McCulloch versus Maryland. They pretended that it didn't exist. And it was barely ever cited from the time that Marshall died until after the Civil War.
Yet now it's hailed as what, the second most cited case next to Brown versus Board of Education in almost 400 references to it in the Supreme Court history?
That's
so
right.
Something changed. What changed?
Well, you know, there's a number of factors and that came together in the post-Reconstruction era. One was that after the Civil War, there was a more nationalistic orientation on the Supreme Court. Another was that the...
By nationalistic, you mean in favor of the nation as a sovereign power?
Yes, that's right. As opposed, yes. When I say nationalistic, I'm talking about in the context of debates over the meaning of the Constitution. A second thing that happened after the Civil War was that the modern law school was invented and the legal profession became more professionalized and placed a greater and greater emphasis on legal research and citation of cases. Law libraries became more widespread and more common and more heavily used. And so it became more of a cultural norm among lawyers to cite cases, to refer to previously decided cases. And a third thing that happened was political. In the 1890s, the Supreme Court became very conservative and issued a series of highly controversial conservative decisions and came under attack by progressives and populists. And so at that time, in order to kind of build up the prestige of the Supreme Court while it was being under attack from these forces, they reached back and felt that John Marshall would be this very useful myth. And they built up a myth of John Marshall and, in fact, orchestrated a national celebration in 1901 to celebrate the 100th anniversary of Marshall's assumption of the chief justiceship. And I think their goal was to shore up the reputation, to sort of fortify the reputation of the Supreme Court by linking their image with this revered figure.
So you're talking about the progressives at that point who want to point to someone who valued the sovereignty of the national government if they were arguing, I assume, things that had to do with child labor or, you know, what were some of the kind of on-the-ground issues that they were wanting to use this case to shore up?
The biggest issues that raised national power constitutional questions involved the control of corporations and the rights of workers. And so we had antitrust laws were fairly new by the 1890s, and one of the cases was a decision striking down the application of the Sherman Antitrust Act to a nationwide sugar monopoly. Another issue was the ability to protect workers' rights. And so the child labor law that you mentioned was probably led to the biggest and most notorious Supreme Court case in the progressive era when the Supreme Court, in a 5-4 decision, struck down the Child Labor Act of 1916.
Tell me more about that. What was it that got struck down?
Well, that was a case called Hammer versus Dagenhart, and Congress had passed a law saying that it would be illegal to ship merchandise, goods that had been manufactured by children across state lines. And they framed the law that way because the court looked like it had upheld other kinds of laws where Congress was trying to prevent something from being sent across state lines. But the court said that Congress had no power to regulate employment because that was a matter for the states, because employment itself didn't cross state lines. And that's how the court analyzed that question. If they had properly applied McCulloch versus Maryland, that shouldn't have mattered, that employment was something that just happens within a state because Congress has the power to regulate interstate commerce. And so it would be efficient in order to prevent child-made goods from being bought and sold across state lines to prevent them from being manufactured at their source.
Hmm. So McCulloch, the case helped or didn't help?
Well, that is the problem with what I with the ambiguity of McCulloch. Mm-hmm. It was characteristic of John Marshall, even when he was making nationalistic decisions, and I think it's particularly true of McCulloch versus Maryland, to include some language to try to pull back a little bit or mask the nationalism. And so that case was cited really on both sides of the argument. And the Supreme Court, the majority that struck down this law, focused on some of the language that seemed more conducive to judicial review. They basically held that the spirit of the Constitution, that the child labor law was not consistent with the spirit of the Constitution, because they interpreted the spirit of the Constitution as being one that allowed states control over things like labor relations.
One thing that struck me reading your book, and includes in your introduction where you mentioned that as you were working on the book and presenting some of the early chapters, you would be asked, whose side are you on? And it seems as if what we experience right now in the country in terms of an incredible divide, this sort of blue state, red state, and polar divisions, that it's been there from the beginning with the states versus the national government, or different iterations of a split, where the Supreme Court finds itself often in a 5-4 very critical juncture point. What are some of the other key times in American history where the McCulloch case comes into play?
Well, I think the other major episode where the McCulloch case comes into play is during the New Deal. And what happens there is the nation goes into this massive economic depression. They elect Franklin Roosevelt on a platform of reform, trying to deal with the economic crisis more aggressively. He comes into office, and in his famous first 100 days, Congress passes numerous pieces of economic legislation to try to deal with the crisis, from emergency mortgage relief to labor relations to Social Security, numerous laws. And these all start to come up before the Supreme Court. And in a series of cases in 1935 and 1936, the court holds them unconstitutional. And that really provokes a constitutional crisis.
So the court is saying that this is overstepping the reach of the national government.
Exactly. The case that was essentially the last straw was decided at the end of the 1935-1936 term, a case called Carter versus Carter Cole, where Congress had passed a law to try to control cutthroat price competition in the coal industry that was leading to labor strife, that was leading to coal miners being paid less than living wages. And the court basically said, Congress doesn't have the power to regulate the economy. After that, Roosevelt, a couple of months later, wins re-election in a landslide. And then in his next term in 1937, he decides he's going to go after the court, and he unveils his famous court packing plan to try to get more liberals on the court so that they can get past this roadblock to economic legislation to try to bring the depression under control.
We're going to look at how that turned out and some cases leading closer to our own age when we continue in a moment with University of the Air. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with David Schwartz. We are talking about the spirit of the Constitution, John Marshall, and the 200-year odyssey of McCulloch versus Maryland, a Supreme Court case that looked at the balance of powers between the national government and states. We were just talking about FDR and the New Deal and his court packing plan. What happened in terms of the court and its use of McCulloch as a precedent in deciding what to do about New Deal legislation?
Well, McCulloch was being used again by both sides of the debate. The conservatives were picking out language from the McCulloch opinion that seemed to support the idea that the Supreme Court could strike down laws where Congress was acting under the, quote, pretext of exercising its powers. Whereas liberals were focused on the language saying that the Constitution was intended to endure for ages to come and be adapted to crises in human affairs. And so while this is going on, while the court is making these conservative decisions, striking down New Deal legislation, New Dealers, both in law practice and in the legal academy, were arguing that this modern Supreme Court has gone off the rails, that if we go back to first principles, as stated by John Marshall in McCulloch versus Maryland, they'll see that Congress needs to have the flexibility to deal with a crisis. And so they tried to argue that kind of interpretation for McCulloch.
And that the crisis would be the Great Depression,
exactly.
The overwhelming need to do something to help people.
Yes.
And how did it turn out?
Well, it turned out that Roosevelt's court packing plan ended up being killed in Congress, but it probably had an effect on the Supreme Court. A couple of judges changed their position on the next round of economic legislation that came before the court, and they started to uphold the laws. And from 1937 on, the court did not strike down any economic legislation until the 1990s.
Another place that the states' right versus national government comes into play has to do with segregation and civil rights. Can you talk about how this early case gets used when those discussions happen?
Yes. So there were basically two sets of civil rights decisions made by the Supreme Court in the years after Brown versus Board of Education.
And just before we get there, with Brown versus Board of Education, such a landmark case, did that case use McCulloch at all?
McCulloch wasn't directly relevant to Brown, so it doesn't show up in the Brown decision. But what's interesting is that the court was concerned in the aftermath of Brown about the backlash from the southern states. And just like the court had done in 1901, in the 1890s and culminating in the 1901 John Marshall celebration, they came up with another John Marshall celebration in 1955, the year after Brown was decided. This was the 200th anniversary of Marshall's birth. I don't think it's a coincidence that another John Marshall celebration happened at this time when the court felt the need to fortify itself against attacks, though this time it was conservative attacks from the South rather than the progressive attacks that we saw in 1901. And so once again, there was a major national John Marshall celebration. The president made an address. There were speeches and meetings around the country, commemorative stamps, et cetera.
Kind of celebrating the power of the judiciary itself? Or?
Yes, exactly.
And how did that affect the civil rights legislation that came afterwards then?
Well, the civil rights legislation that came afterwards, there were basically two major initiatives that were taken. One was a bill to regulate the 1964 Civil Rights Act made it illegal to discriminate on the basis of race, sex, religion, national origin in employment and in places of public accommodation, that is, businesses that are held open to the public. And that was upheld when it was challenged in the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court did rely on McCulloch versus Maryland to say that Congress had an implied power under its commerce powers to regulate private businesses in this way. The other place that McCulloch came up was in voting rights legislation. The 15th Amendment, which prohibits discrimination in voting on the basis of race, has an enforcement provision that seems to invoke the language of McCulloch. And so when the Supreme Court upheld various challenge provisions of the Voting Rights Act, they tended to rely on McCulloch versus Maryland, saying Congress has broad implied powers to do what it thinks is necessary to protect the right to vote.
It's kind of interesting that McCulloch, Marshall, who owned over 100 slaves, his ruling in McCulloch is being used to help kind of attack racial discrimination. There are some ironies to that, for sure. So would you say overall that McCulloch versus Maryland has been used more often in support of what you would say would be good progress in the nation's history? You know, you mentioned that both conservatives and liberals are pulling from different parts of it. If you take a look at the over 300 instances in which McCulloch has been brought in as a precedent to Supreme Court decisions, does it seem as if it's being used in a positive way overall, or is it a mixed report card?
I think it's a mixed report card, but when it's interpreted properly, the logic of McCulloch versus Maryland is to say that Congress does have sufficient powers to has sufficient implied powers to enact the purposes of the Constitution and to efficiently implement its delegated powers.
I mean, one way that we can look back at history and see it being played out is when you've got the National Guard present in a state where the governor is trying to block an African American student from attending school, and the national forces are brought in to insist that this is a rule. So you can see it become something quite striking when you have the states versus the national government on an issue. You mentioned in your book that this case also came up in 2012. With the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare. Can you talk about that briefly?
Yes. So one of the key issues in the Obamacare case was whether it was constitutional to impose the so-called individual mandate. This was the requirement that everyone either purchase health insurance or else pay a tax penalty if they went uninsured. That was challenged as unconstitutional, as outside the powers of Congress. And the court very nearly struck down Obamacare on that basis because everyone understood that without the individual mandate, it would be very hard to make the law work. Laws that where states had similar kinds of laws without an original mandate, without an individual mandate, the law tended to collapse. The court ended up upholding it narrowly by a 5-4 vote under the taxing power, but they said that there was no power under the Commerce Clause to implement the individual mandate. And interestingly, both sides of this argument cited McCulloch versus Maryland. And the key opinion was written by Chief Justice Roberts, who once again turned to the conservative language in McCulloch to justify saying Congress didn't have the power to require the individual mandate as an economic regulation, even though they could do it as a tax.
You wrote something at that point, or more recently, I guess, in a Texas case entitled Why John Roberts Should Have Listened to John Marshall. Can you talk about that? That's from 2018.
Yes. So a Texas case found some new twist to try to say that the individual mandate is unconstitutional, even under the taxing power. My op-ed in The Atlantic was making the point that had John Roberts read McCulloch versus Maryland properly, he would have to agree that Congress didn't have to rely on the taxing power, that they could have relied on the Commerce Clause, and it was an implied power under the Commerce Clause to require the individual mandate. Again, that would be, had he applied the logic of McCulloch versus Maryland, then any law that is expedient, conducive, helpful, useful to enacting a national economic regulation like healthcare should be constitutional. And clearly, the individual mandate was that.
If you imagine coming back to do an interview 10, 15 years from now, and I ask you, you know, so what's new with McCulloch versus Maryland, where do you see it coming into our discourse if you had to look into the future, which I know historians don't generally do?
I think the two biggest problems facing our country now, and they are huge problems, are climate change and economic inequality. And both of those things are going to raise the kinds of issues that are addressed in McCulloch versus Maryland. If laws get passed to try to address those problems, you can be sure that someone is going to challenge them as unconstitutional. They're going to say, there is no enumerated power to regulate pollution. They're going to say, there's no enumerated power to regulate wealth or economic inequality. And those are strict construction type arguments. And so I think McCulloch versus Maryland will come up again because the supporters of those laws will be arguing, yes, but there are implied powers that Congress has to address all national problems, including these. And I hope if I'm back in 10 or 15 years, the court will have gotten it right and recognize that Congress does have the authority to address pressing national problems like that.
In the spirit of the Constitution.
Yes.
You spend a lot of time with sort of with John Marshall, I'm sure, as you wrote the book, looking at his letters, at the way he wrote opinions, his life. What's your verdict at the end? John Marshall, you said sometimes he's been turned into a myth or an iconic figure rather than who he really was. Well, what's your ultimate verdict, having finished this book?
It's hard not to like John Marshall when you read his biography. He was, in addition to being this very convivial person, he was a down-to-earth person, somebody who has accomplished so much in his life and has risen to such an exalted position as Chief Justice of the United States. One might think that a person like that would be full of himself. And from all the accounts of contemporaries, he was a genuine down-to-earth person. At the same time, he's a human being with flaws, and we can't overlook the fact that he was a major slave owner, which is something that has really been downplayed, even in his, even in the best biographies about him. In addition, I think it's important not to get too caught up in myths, because constitutional law shouldn't turn on the question, what would John Marshall do? He's not the Chief Justice anymore. Not every idea that he had was sound and good policy and good law. And so I think it's important to recognize that a person could be a great man and at the same time a flawed human being, and that we don't have to follow his every idea.
Would you suggest Lin-Manuel Miranda write a John Marshall musical?
I would like Lin-Manuel Miranda to write a musical about several of our founding generation, including Marshall. That would be great.
My guest has been David Schwartz, author of The Spirit of the Constitution, John Marshall, and the 200-Year Odyssey of McCulloch versus Maryland. Thanks for illuminating this surprisingly important case.
Thank you.
I'm Emily Auerbach, hoping you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Year.
Let me tell you what I wish I'd known when I was young and dreamed of glory. You have no control.
Who lives, who dies, who tells your story?
President Jefferson.
I'll give him this. His financial system is a work of genius. I couldn't undo it if I tried. And I tried.
Who lives, who dies, who tells your story?
President Madison. He took our country from bankruptcy to prosperity. I hate to admit it, but he doesn't get enough credit for all the credit he gave us.
Who lives, who dies, who tells your story?
Every other founding father's story gets told. Every other founding father gets to grow old.
And when you're gone, who remembers your name? Who keeps your flame?